And they both provide insight into the broader historical trends in the human rights discourse, as well as how they engage with sort of a mythical, not mythical, but a very sort of recreated past of colonialism and imperialism in Africa, in Labuda's case, and of sort of American interventionist politics, or I guess international, since the British were involved as well, in Shannon's paper. And they seek to answer the question how different historical actors define human rights and how they have used these different specific definitions of human rights for political purposes. So I just have some questions I'll throw out for both papers and sort of combined my comments. One of the things that connects the two papers is, of course, the relationship between international and national agendas and concepts of human rights. The difference is that in one case, the nations are making comments about human rights in order to make demands for themselves, Kenya, Sudan, and Democratic Republic of Congo, whereas the other, you see this kind of debate between what constitutes national human rights or nationally defined human rights and individual human rights in the case of the Iranian nation and the Iranian students in the U.S., with the United States government sort of being the entity to convince. The two discussions draw out the tensions between the demands for human rights themselves and the claim to protect the rights of others. And I'm curious to see if you can talk more about where these converge and where these diverge. How, for example, the International Criminal Court claims to protect individuals within African nations is simultaneously a statement about the inabilities of the state and the rejection of the state's claim to sovereignty, and how claims for generalized human rights among Iranian students and U.S. politicians, Iranian state and U.S. politicians in the pre sort of mid-1970s era undercut the individual rights that students were claiming. What is the disconnect between the demand, between the theory of demand and the theory of protection? And how does this relate to international, national, or pan-African, in that case, and individual discourses? So a little bit more specifically, I was thinking that this question that that Shannon brought up about the distinction between economic and social rights, and in this sort of earlier modernization discourse about economic rights within these nations, earlier sort of conflicts within African nations and the international community. For example, in the 1970s, you have sort of lingering cases of colonialism, and part of the arguments made in former Portuguese colonies, for example, Mozambique, Angola, Guinea-Bissau, is the right to sort of an economic equality, and that was framed particularly within a kind of Marxist discourse. Obviously, that's not the case in the late 90s and 2000s, but how is it, is there an economic sort of undertone to some of the claims to European neocolonialism? And then also jumping into the later context of the contemporary period, for example, in Congo, are there discussions about the economics of the mining industry, for example, that or are there investments in the economics of the mining industry that might have something to do with why there's this kind of shift in the willingness or unwillingness of Congolese officials to accept the interventions from the International Criminal Court? And sort of what economic repercussions might that bring? And then I'd love to hear more about kind of what the economic rights discourse means for not just the Iranian nation, but also the Iranian students in the United States. Do they experience a different kind of economic right by living in the United States, by having access to education in the United States, and how does that help them kind of challenge those other concepts? And then I'll just a couple of really quick questions. What sources are you using? How do they present the perspective of individuals and states? Do you have a protagonist? Because you're both dealing with very kind of a multiple actors, and I'm wondering sort of who's the protagonist in your stories? Whose perspective are you most sort of invested in drawing out? And then the historical context, you mentioned at the end of your paper that you were going to bring it back to sort of earlier discussions about neocolonialism and the relationship between the human rights discourse and decolonization, Patrick, but I'm wondering if you can also think about how this is a reaction to the late 90s or mid-90s to early 2000s kind of expectations about the democratization of African governments and how these nations in particular are kind of reacting to that discourse as well. And then in Matthew's case, you probably go into this in your dissertation, but I'm interested in the connections to other student protests. Brad mentioned a protest in Indonesia in the late 1960s. Obviously, there's an international movement here. And also, if the U.S. government is maybe reluctant to listen to the students because they're suspicion about students in general, and at the same time, if how this might connect to protests in, say, the Middle East. I don't know if you're familiar with Betty Anderson's work on the American University of Beirut about students and sort of shifting ideas about rights as students she looks at the whole 20th century, but in the middle of the 20th century. Okay, so I said too much. Leave it at that.
Well, do you want us to address those kind of in turn, or should we try to maybe integrate them into... Either one's fine.
Go ahead.
Respond.
Okay.
I'll just address this issue of who the protagonist is, whose perspective I'm representing or presenting. I think I may have left out perhaps what was the most important paragraph in my presentation in a way, because I argue that there's a split between state sovereignty and popular sovereignty in a way that what's happening here is on one hand, we have African governments that are invoking state sovereignty to shield themselves from the International Criminal Court's intervention. And then on the other hand, we have African civil society groups that supposedly represent the African population that are overwhelmingly still supportive of the court. And this is really hard to explain in a way how it's possible that you have, in Kenya at least, a democratically elected government that has denounced the court, where at the same time you have a population that supposedly is in favor of the court, and civil society groups that are representing Kenyans and arguing for more intervention